Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for June's Small Animal Practice Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, European Specialist in Veterinary Anesthesia and Analgesia, Alessandra Matisis. Thank you, Alessandra. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everybody. So today we will speak about fluid therapy and what we should do in a small animal patients. What we will go through, unfortunately, is a little bit of physiology of the body fluids, which has to be done because we need to understand what's going on. And then why, who, and how much fluids we should give. Which type of fluids do we use more commonly? I will not go through all the fluids, of course. And then to put everything in practice, we will go through a case discussion. So a little bit of physiology to start with. Total body water is 60% of body weight. And of this, as you can see in this table here, 40% is intracellular, therefore included into the cells, and 20% is extracellular. The extracellular fluid is at its time divided in interstitial fluid, so in between the cells, and then only 5% of the total body water is plasma, so that's not very much, as you can see. The vessels are constituted from semi-permeable membranes, which means that they will allow fluid, for example, to go through permeably, easily, but some solute cannot go through them. And these are, for example, in the extracellular fluid, you have sodium chloride and some protein. In the intravascular fluid, you have sodium chloride and a lot of protein. And in the intracellular fluid, you will have potassium and proteins. And these particles who cannot cross these membranes are called osmotically active particles, and they produce what is called the osmolarity or osmolality of the plasma. The normal plasma osmolarity is 280 to 320 milliosmol per liter in the dog and the cat. And I will explain why this is important later when I speak about fluids. Also, protein exerts osmotic pressure, but this is called oncotic pressure because it's due to protein. And these protein attract positively charged ion and form what is called the colloid osmotic pressure. So all these different pressures you hear when we speak about fluids are all explained here. Another thing you will hear when you speak about fluids is tonicity and the tonicity of a fluid. And this is simply the ability to initiate water movement. So the more a fluid is tonic, the more it will be able to initiate water movement. And this depends on the number of effective osmoles and not on their size. This is a bit of a complicated equation, but what I want you to focus on is not really on the equation. This is what is called the Starling equation. And if we get the, sorry, I'm trying to get the pointer to work. Here. If we get to the pointer, this is the vessel and it's semi-permeable membrane. You can see that you have the hydrostatic pressure of the capillary and the hydrostatic pressure of the interstitium. And these pressures are pressure which push fluid away from them. So the hydrostatic pressure pushes fluid out of the capillary. And then you have the oncotic pressure in here, which is instead active and sucks fluid in the vessel. So you have the oncotic pressure in the capillary, which is due to a lot of proteins which we have in the capillary and will suck the fluid in. And then because in the interstitium you don't have a lot of protein, the oncotic pressure which sucks fluid out of the vessel will be lower than the one that sucks in. And the movement of fluid through the vessel is due to this Starling equation, so to the equilibrium between all this movement going in and out. And this explains, for example, if you have a patient which is, for example, hypoalbuminemic, the oncotic pressure in the vessel will be decreased, and therefore the force sucking fluids into the vessel will be decreased, and therefore you have edema. Or the same if you have a patient with, for example, congestive heart failure, you will have an increase in the hydrostatic pressure in the capillary, and therefore the fluids will be pushed out of the capillary, and therefore you have edema or pleural effusion as well. So this explains a bit the physiology and how fluids move into the body. Unfortunately, we have now discovered the glycocalyx. The glycocalyx is a mesh of proteoglycans and sialoprotein, which, as you can see in this picture here, they sit in the vessels. And you can see there this little arborization. And they have a very, very important role in fluid therapy and in movements of fluids. And to the point that the Starling equation is not true anymore, and we have now the modified Starling equation, which is exactly the same equation that you had before, but it explains that all the movement occur in between the vessel and the subglycocalyx and not the interstitial. So it is the glycocalyx which is important in your fluid movement. And it has been discovered also that this glycocalyx is altered by hypervolemia, sepsis, hyperglycemia, and trauma, which are all things that you see quite often in our small animal patient when they're ill. So we need to keep this in mind, because I will repeat this later, but if the glycocalyx is not intact, then every fluid will leak out of your vessel. So it doesn't matter anymore about your Starling equation. So let's speak about the glycocalyx a bit more in depth. I'm just joking. Let's keep on with our fluid therapy. Why do we use fluid therapy? Well, the first thing you will all think about is to rehydrate the patient, which we know, and also to restore intravascular volume. Also, you will use fluid therapy to maintain electrolyte concentration, to maintain acid-base equilibrium, and the most important thing, which we don't often think about, you will use fluid therapy to maintain cardiac output, organ perfusion, and to give oxygen delivery. Another equation which explains why you need to maintain cardiac output with fluid therapy to give oxygen delivery. So this is your oxygen delivery equation you can see here. So oxygen delivery is due to cardiac output times oxygen content. So your cardiac output is due to the volume of fluids you have in your vessel, and your oxygen content is depending on the hemoglobin and on the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood. So as you can see, what is extremely important for your oxygen delivery is cardiac output, hence fluid therapy, but also your hemoglobin. So you don't want to dilute this fluid too much when you give a big amount of crystalloids. You will have to think about what the PCV of your patient is, because you don't want to dilute too much the hemoglobin. And we will go through this later as well. How to decide who to give fluid therapy to? Well, of course, the history. Has the patient been vomiting? Has he had diarrhea for months? Does he look extremely dehydrated? And all these things. And then it is very important that you do a physical examination. The two systems you will have to look at are the cardiovascular and the respiratory system. And it is important, for example, that you feel the pulses, you feel the heart rate, and you write down the heart rate, because it will be important to see how well you are doing. And then the respiratory rate, has he got dyspnea, is it just tachypneic, just look at these things as well. You also have to look at the volume and the hydration, and I will explain the difference between volume and hydration. And then also the mentation, because a patient which is dehydrated or hypovolemic will be depressed. And one of the things you will have to look at with your fluid therapy is this patient, does he look a bit brighter? Has he perked up a little bit with your fluids? This is extremely important and often forgotten. You absolutely need to be able to differentiate between dehydration and hypovolemia. Dehydration is a loss of pure water over a prolonged period of time, and the different compartments which we have seen in the table in the beginning are in equilibrium in between them. Meanwhile, hypovolemia is a reduction in the intravascular fluid volume. So if you say, I'm giving a bolus of fluid because the patient is dehydrated, that's not exactly true, and you will see why. So a hypovolemic patient will present differently depending on how hypovolemic he is, of course, and how well he can compensate. But the things you will see are, for example, tachycardia. You will see that the pulse amplitude will be increased, so those pulses will be bouncy, they will be hyperdynamic. You will feel them and they will be very strong, but they will be empty, so they're very, very bouncy. If the patient does not compensate, or it is very severe hypovolemia, then the pulse amplitude may be decreased. But more often, they're very bouncy. The mucous membrane may be white, gray, or muddy. The patient will be depressed with cold extremities, and they can be tachypneic. Tension, unfortunately, cuts. Cuts are always different, and cuts which are, for example, in hypovolemic shock can present bradycardic or normocardic. So don't always rely on heart rate when you look at cuts. They're always a species to their own. If you look at lab things, the urine output will be decreased, but the concentration will be increased. The lactate will be increased, which is quite an important way to monitor how well you're doing. And then after whole blood loss, the PCV will take approximately 6 hours to decrease. So if you have imponent hemorrhage, which just happened, your PCV may be normal, but your total solids will decrease more rapidly. Another thing which is important when you look at PCV and total solid is that you don't know what the PCV of that patient is. So it is important to do serial PCVs, but if the PCV is borderline low, you don't know if he has bled, if he was already anemic, you don't know these things. So it is important to see what's happening. When you correct hypovolemia, your correction has to be fast and dynamic. You need to assess the patient frequently. So you start your bolus of fluid, you get your heart rate, you start your bolus of fluid, and then you reassess the heart rate. You don't put the dog on a bolus of fluid, do five consults, and then come back and see. You have to watch him and see how he's doing because it is a very dynamic process, unlike what happens for dehydration. You can correct with crystalloids, and you will read in every book that if you have severe hypovolemia, then you should use shock dose, which is up to 90 mL per kilo in the dog and 60 mL per kilo in the cat. But sincerely, I don't know many people who just give 90 mL per kilo in the dog as a bolus altogether. What you should do is give, for example, if it's severely hypovolemic, you give 20 mL per kilo, and then you assess the pulse rate and you see how well the pulse rate has come down. If it's like slightly hypovolemic, you can give 5 mL per kilo over 15 minutes. Of course, if the patient has like a ruptured aorta and is bleeding out, you just put your pump on 999, even if it's like a 1 kilo dog. As I have already said several times, it is important to reassess perfusion parameters. So you have given your bolus of fluids, but the heart rate has improved. So it went from 180 to 160, but this is still not within the normal limits. So because your bolus has worked, what you have to do is give another bolus and then reassess. Practically, what you have to do is do something. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, then do something else and think about doing something else. If, for example, you're in theater or this dog arrives to you and he is tachycardic and you don't know why he is tachycardic and you don't think he's in pain, you don't see other causes of tachycardia, you can try to do what is the fluid challenge, and this will help you understand if you need to give a bolus of fluid. So what you do with a fluid challenge is that you actually give a bolus of fluid 5 to 20 mL per kilo over 20 minutes. And then if you have a positive hemodynamic response, means that the heart rate has decreased, the pulses feel fuller, then it means that the patient was actually hypovolemic, and therefore you start your more aggressive fluid therapy. Many patients, we are very well constructed, so our body compensates very well for hypovolemia. And many patients will be hypovolemic, but they will just be tachycardic because the body is the heart is pumping harder to maintain blood pressure. Therefore, they will be bright and everything because they are compensating, but this doesn't mean that they're not hypovolemic. In fact, healthy patients can cope with acute blood loss to under 25% of their blood volume, which is quite a little bit. And but signs of hypovolemia may not be obvious until you have an acute blood loss of 40%, which is like almost 0.5% of your blood volume. And another thing is that under general anesthesia, you use opioids, you use isoflurane, and these things, they blunt the response to hypovolemia. So if the patient is bleeding under general anesthesia, you don't wait for the heart rate to come up to do something because maybe you're blunting the response. So if you see blood loss, you need to do something immediately. The total blood volume of a dog is 80 to 90 mL per kilo, and of the cat is 60 to 70 mL per kilo. So what you have to do if you're, for example, in theater or you get this dog who's bleeding, you need to approximate the percentage of blood loss. To do this, you can weigh the swabs, look at the suction, how much have you got in the suction, or just approximate. And then you replace this with crystalloids. You would use 3 times the volume lost. If you use colloids, you use 1 to 1.5 times the volume lost. But if you use whole blood, you only use 1 time the volume lost. And I will explain soon why you have to use these volumes when you use these things, but just remember this. So if the dog has lost 200 mils of blood, and you want to replace the blood loss with crystalloids, you will have to use 3 times 200 mils, which is 600 mils of blood to replace. As a rule of thumb to know what to do, in healthy, non-anesthetized patients, if you have 10-15% of blood loss, you will replace it with crystalloids, but you will replace 3 times the volume loss. If you have 15-25% of blood loss, you can replace with colloids, and you will replace 1-1.5 times the volume loss. And if you lose more than 25%, then you will replace with blood of blood product. I fully understand these blood products are not very easily available. They're difficult to find. So in that case, you just keep going with colloids if you have them. But if the patient is old, if the patient is not healthy to start with, or if the patient is under general anesthesia because they cannot compensate that well, if you have more than 20% of blood loss, you should start thinking about blood products. I'm not saying that this is what I do. Sometimes I have 25% blood loss and I'm still just giving crystalloids because I am replacing volume and the surgeon has taken control of the hemorrhage and the patient was actually young. So you need to look at clinical signs. But you also need to think that under general anesthesia, they may not be able to show those clinical signs. Speaking about dehydration, you probably have seen this table several times in your life, and it shows you the level of dehydration on the left, and then on the right, you have the clinical signs of that level of dehydration. So under 5%, dehydration is not detectable. Over 15%, it is compatible with life. And in between, you have all signs, for example, loss of skin elasticity, which becomes worse and worse the more the dehydration becomes, and then dry mucous membrane when you're between 6 and 10%. You have oliguria, and then at 10-12%, the skin does not return in place, the mucous membrane are dry, and the eyes are sunken into the orbits. So practically, as I said, under 5% is not detectable, and over 15% it's compatible with death. So what people say is that if you see signs of dehydration, then you can guesstimate that the patient is 7 to 10% dehydrated, because a higher or lower than that, you cannot see it or he's dead. Signs are also very subjective, like my dog, I tent his skin and it doesn't come back, but I am sure he's not dehydrated. And how dry are the mucous membrane? I always argue this as well. Like the more tacky, they're less tacky. I don't know. But also your PCV and total solids may be increased and your urine-specific gravity will be increased. When you want to correct dehydration, fluid therapy has to be titrated over 24 hours. So in that case, you can put the patient on fluid and go do your consult. You can even do 10 consults and then come back. So it is not something that you have to be extremely worried about and something you have to reassess very frequently. The only thing is that dehydration always exists with a little bit of hypovolemia. So every patient which will be dehydrated will also be a little bit hypovolemic. So it is good that you correct this hypovolemia quite fast and then you correct your dehydration over 24 hours. So first, give a bolus of fluid, and then you can titrate the rest over 24 hours. So what is this rest? Well, to calculate how much you need to give, you have your maintenance fluid rate, which is 50 mL per kilo per day. And then you have to add to this your replacement fluid rate, which you will get through your dehydration percentage, and then the ongoing losses. So maintenance is 50 mL per kilo per day. Replacement is your percentage of dehydration times your body weight times 1,000 to transform it in mil per day. And then you need to measure your ongoing losses. You add all this together and you get how much fluid therapy you need to give in the 24 hours. Under general anesthesia, everything is a little bit different and a little bit complicated, but there has been these guidelines which have been published in 2013 in the Journal of American Animal Hospital Association. And I actually think you can find them for free, but I'm not sure. But I think they are, you can get them free. And what they say, if you see in the box, which I have highlighted at the bottom, is that as a rule of thumb for cats, the initial rate should be 3 mL per kilo per hour. And for dogs, the initial rate should be 5 mL per kilo per hour. I don't know how old you are, but until 5 years ago, we used to give 10 mL per kilo per hour to everything under general anesthesia. Well, actually, this has been said to be contraindicated, as you can see in the first point. Provide the maintenance rate, but always less than 10 mL per kilo per hour. Another thing that is important, you can see in this point here, is that a typical guideline would be to reduce the anesthetic fluid rate by 25% every hour until the maintenance rate are reached. So you start in the dog at 5 mL per kilo per hour, and after an hour, you decrease this by 25%. So this is something that has actually quite changed quite a bit. How to monitor fluid therapy and if you're doing well or not? Well, the most important thing, which I have said and re-said already several times, is that you have to look at clinical sign. Look at how well the heart rate is changing. Look at how the pulses are feeling. If you're correcting dehydration, look at all those dehydration parameters we have spoken about, but always look at your clinical signs. Other things you can look at are acute changes in body weight. So if the patient, for example, in one day has gained 2 kilo, well, he's retaining all his fluids and it's not going really well. You need to change something there. You can look at the arterial blood pressure, but this is mostly in the non-compensated patient because, as I said before, a hypovolemic patient will increase his heart rate to maintain blood pressure. So if you start worrying about your hypovolemia when the blood pressure is already low, it's already late because the patient is not compensating anymore. In the past, we always used to look at central venous pressure, and nowadays people think that central venous pressure is, someone actually said, as useful as the phases of the moon to look at how well you're doing with your volume. Well, sincerely, the number may be as useful as the phases of the moon, but looking at trends is quite important. So if your patient is on fluid therapy and, for example, his recumbent does not move too much, then looking at how your central venous pressure is changing may help you with your fluid therapy. Central venous pressure, though, depends on venous return, on right ventricular compliance. So if you have congestive heart failure, for example, it will not work very well. On the peripheral venous tone and on the posture of the patient. So if he's moving or he's standing or he'll be recumbent, things will change. You can also monitor urine output and urine specific gravity. And urine output is said that it has to be at least 1 mL per kilo per hour. But in the hospitalized patient, for example, multi-trauma, which is on opioid and which is stressed, I kind of accept even 0.7 mL per kilo per hour. And then you can do serial blood work. So look at your PCV and total solids. Are they decreasing? Are they decreasing too much? Look at your blood lactate. Is it becoming normalized? And all these things. You have many things that can help you monitor fluid therapy. So let's go to our type of fluids. There are four fluids of life. One is milk, one is Coke, one is beer, and one is Hartmann's. I'm just joking. But what I heard at a talk on fluid therapy from a human fluid therapist, he said that if beer doesn't get you, then Hartmann's will. And this is important because you need to understand that fluids are kind of drugs. You don't just put the patient on a bolus of fluid and then go away because they contain electrolytes, they can be acidifying, they can be alkalinizing, they can change things in the patient. So this is what we will go through now. When you use crystalloids, as I said before, you need to give 3 times the volume lost. And the reason is because crystalloids equilibrate very quickly with the extravascular compartment. In fact, after 1 hour, only 1/3 of the crystalloids you have given will stay in the intravascular space. So remember that patient who lost 200 mL of blood and we had to give him 600 mL. After 1 hour, only 200 mL will be in the intravascular space, and this is why we had to give 300 mL. Hartmann solution is probably the most used, and this is because it's the most physiological solution. Hartmann's is slightly hypotonic compared to plasma, but really we can call it as an isotonic solution. It contains lactate as a bicarbonate precursor, and after the lactate is metabolized, it becomes very slightly hypotonic. It also contains calcium, so you have to pay attention not to use Hartmann's when, for example, you're doing a blood transfusion or if you have to infuse sodium bicarbonate, for example. And then it contains potassium. So many people tend to use saline, for example, in cats with ureteral obstruction or dogs which are Addisonian. But as you can see in this paper published in 2010, they were comparing saline, normal saline, and the Ringer solution in cats with experimentally induced ureteral obstruction. And they saw that both of them actually were safe and effective in cats, but lactated Ringer was more effective in restoring acid base and electrolyte balance compared to saline. So actually, the recommended fluid to use in cats with ureteral obstruction is now Hartmann's. Although it contains potassium, the concentration of potassium is not that high that it will worsen the situation. And the same in Addison. It has not been proven with a paper, but it is exactly the same thing. Saline instead is used very little. It is slightly hypertonic in dogs and isotonic in cats. And it is an acidifying solution, so it tends to give hyperchloremic acidosis in the patient. And most of our small animal patients, when they're ill, they tend to be a little bit acidotic. So giving saline in this case will just worsen the situation. I normally use saline when I have patients with brain masses or patients with metabolic alkalosis. And the reason why I use saline in patients with brain masses or traumatic brain injury, for example, it's because it is slightly hypertonic and therefore it has good effect, and it does not contain calcium. And calcium is involved in some metabolism of the glutamate, which is responsible for worsening of intracranial pressure in a second phase. So when I have a patient with traumatic brain injury, which I need to give fluids to, I will choose to give saline. Hypertonic saline is a very tonic saline, and you remember in the beginning we were talking about tonicity, so the capability that this fluid has to initiate water movement. Well, hypertonic saline is extremely tonic and hyperosmolar, so it has the capacity to rapidly expand plasma volume. Unfortunately, being a crystalloid, these effects are short-lived. So after 1 hour, only one-third will be left into your blood vessels. The dose I normally use of hypertonic saline is 4 mL per kilo over 10 minutes, and always remember to use follow-up fluids. And I would use hypertonic saline, for example, again in traumatic brain injury because it decreases intracranial pressure and at the same time it restores volume if the patient had, had trauma. Or hypertonic saline in a patient which is extremely hypovolemic following a trauma, which is not head trauma, can work as well. In GDV's patient, it is a very fast way of restoring volume. It also has the capability of increasing cardiac contractility and improving microcirculation, but it has side effects. It can cause rebound hypotension. It can cause bradycardia because it expands the volume so fast and it contains a lot of sodium. It can cause ventricular dysrhythmia. It can cause bronchoconstriction, hypernatremia because it causes a lot of sodium, hypokalemia because it doesn't contain any potassium, hemolysis because it is so hyperosmolar, and then thrombosis. And because it re-expands the volume so fast, it can cause potential rehemorrhage. So sincerely, if you have a patient which, for example, has an hemangiosarcoma and you still haven't removed the spleen, then I would maybe stay away from hypertonic saline for resuscitation in this one, or, give a bit less. Other crystalloid solution, just to mention that they are crystalloid solution, are potassium chloride, which you will use mostly for supplementation. And the only thing I want to say about this is that there is a maximum rate, which is of 0.5 milliequivalent per kilo per hour. And then sodium bicarbonate, which you would use for metabolic acidosis, well, against metabolic acidosis, when the pH of the patient is less than 7.1 and the base deficit is less than 0.7 millimoles per liter. There is a formula to calculate, but I will not go through this. I just wanted to mention these fluids. The important thing is that when you use sodium bicarbonate, you should not use it with Hartmann's because, as I said before, Hartmann contains calcium and it can precipitate with sodium bicarbonate. Dextrose is an interesting crystalloid, dextrose 5%. It is isotonic, but once dextrose is metabolized, then it becomes hypotonic. It actually becomes like water for injection. It is not useful to restore circulating volume because you can you imagine you need 12 liters of dextrose 5% to restore the volume of 1 liter. That is because the glucose gets metabolized and the water gets produced and consumed and all these things. So it is important that you don't use dextrose 5% to restore circulating volume. And also you don't use it to treat hypoglycemia because then you will be left only for water with injections in your vessel. And that is not good because it will make the cells swell and they can suffer from that. I want to say burst, but it's a bit dramatic. It can happen though. Other fluids that you will use for volume resuscitation is colloids. Collodes contain macromolecules, so they cannot go through the semipermeable membranes of the vessel. Colloids include synthetic colloids, for example, gelatin, dextran, and starches, or natural colloids, for example, plasma and albumin, and then you have hemoglobin-based oxygen-carrying solution, for example, oxyglobin. The effect of colloids are sustained, and this mostly for the synthetic colloids, so starch, dextran, and gelatin have sustained effects. They increase colloid osmotic pressure, being colloids, and they have to be used with crystalloids. The number of colloidal molecule is important for volume expansion, but the size of the molecule is important for survival time. So the more molecule and the bigger they are, the more the effects of your colloids will be. The colloids you think more often of, and I actually think the one that are more readily available, are hydroxyl ethyl starch. These are hydroxylated modified polymer of amylopectin, which is a mouthful to say, but they are synthetic anyway. And they are described for their molecular weight and their substitution number. I know this sounds a bit too physic, but if you look at a bug, for example, this is a bug of Volvan, you can see that you have, it's an hydroxyl ethyl starch 130/0.4. And I'm just mentioning this because if you're interested in looking at study, you cannot think that one colloid is similar to the other, and they will all be defined by this thing here and not with their name. Colloids, unfortunately, starches have been accused of having many side effects, and these are coagulopathy, they can give anaphylactic reaction, and they can give renal impairment in patients with pre-existing renal disease. And the one which you most have heard speaking the most about is probably Volvan. And Volvan had very good effect. It improved microcirculation. It has faster and more prolonged volume restoration. And it is more effective than crystalloid in improving tissue oxygenation. So it is a fantastic drug. But unfortunately, what happened is that this Joachim Bolt wrote a lot of publication on Volvan and starches, and he was actually one of the best advocates of Volvan. And they had to retract 90 of his publication, more than 90 of his publication, because he didn't have ethical approval and because he had a bit tricked his result. So they retracted his paper, so we didn't have a lot of evidence to support starches. And then there was three big trials, which are the VISEP, the CHEST, and the 6S trials, which were published. And these trials were comparing starches to saline or Ringer acetate. And these trials brought to the suspension of marketing authorization of all starches product in Europe in 2013. And this is because these trials showed that if you were using colloid rather than crystalloid, then the patient needed more renal replacement therapy. They were more likely to have acute kidney injury, or actually in one study, they had higher mortality rate at 28 days. So everybody got really worried. Everybody said colloids kill patients or give them renal failure, and they removed them from the market in June 2013. This is the drug alert, which came out and was sent to everybody in June 2013. You can see these are all the products that were removed from the market. And the action you can read up there is within 48 hours, so urgent. But in October 2014, these products were placed back on the market. And the reason being a little bit because these trials were not extremely well run. For example, they were colloids were given on patients in ICU. So these patients were not volume depleted, or the patients which had colloids, some of them already had acute kidney injury. So there was a little bit of things that didn't work very well in these trials. So in 2014, they've put Volvan and starches back on the market, saying that because of the risk of kidney injury and mortality, hydroxyl ethyl starch solution must no longer be used in patients with sepsis or burn injury or critically ill patients. Hydroxyl ethyl starch solutions may continue to be used to treat hypovolemia caused by acute blood loss. However, doctors should monitor the patient's kidney function after hydroxyl ethyl starch administration. So they've put it back on the market saying you can use it for hypovolemia. And therefore, I recommend that because we don't have easy access to blood, we all have easy access to colloid or Volvan in our shelves in your practice. You remember that glycocalyx we spoke about in the beginning? Well, if the patient is not healthy, for example, sepsis, which is a case in which you would give a lot of fluid, or if you give too much fluid, so in case of hypervolemia, then the glycocalyx, as you see on the picture on the right, is destroyed. And in this case, any fluid will leak out of the vascular endothelium. So this is why I don't recommend to give colloids in sepsis, because the glycocalyx is not there anymore, and your colloids will leak out exactly like your crystalloids do. So you spend more money and you give something which may have some bad effect, but you don't have the results you wanted to have. They have done also several studies lately on the effect of starches in the dogs, and they have looked at the coagulation parameters in dogs, and they have seen that a large bolus of tetra starch has significant coagulopathy and platelet dysfunction for less than 24 hours. If you use it instead as a CRI at 1 mL per kilo per hour, then tetra starches do not affect coagulation. The bolus was extremely high. I don't remember if it was 20 or 40 mils per kilo, but it is something you would not use in practice. So if you need to give a bolus, don't worry about giving a bolus. Looking at the effects of starches on the kidney in dogs, they have seen that there was no increase in creatinine in ICU dogs, but then they have done studies in dogs with SIRS undergoing laparotomy, and they have seen that there was a high urinary N-galamine. And N-galamine is a very novel parameter you look at, and it is to look at kidney injury. And it is actually an earlier parameter than increased urea and creatinine. So maybe it has some effect on the kidney in dogs. So when to use hydroxylated starch? You use them when crystalloids alone are not sufficient. So your patient is bleeding out, he is bleeding too fast, you put your crystalloids on 999. It is not enough, you have to use your colloids. You would use it for hemorrhage. Some people still use it in sepsis in small animal patients, but I would try other things. I would stay away from that because, as I said, it will leak out of the vessel. And use it at the lowest effective dose and for less than 24 hours because then you may see side effects on your kidneys. And again, when using, you should monitor renal function if the patient stays with you long enough to do that. When Voluven was removed from the market, I don't know if we all did, but we used gelatins. And those of you who are a bit older will have used gelatins a lot. There is not much on gelatins in published or in books, but they come from degradation of bovine collagen. The problems of gelatin is that they may have given anaphylactic reaction, but the rate would decrease a lot if you pretreated the patient with histamine blockers. You have two types of gelatin. One is gelofusin, which is in saline, and one is geloplasma, which was in ringer lactate solution. The rate and the of gelatin depends on the reason of administration, and you would use 1 to 2 mL per kilo per hour for colloid osmotic pressure support, 2 to 5 mL per kilo as a bolus for correction for hypovolemia, and as a bolus for acute blood loss. And then you have fresh frozen plasma. Fresh frozen plasma is part of the natural colloid, and unfortunately, I would not advise to use fresh frozen plasma for colloidal support. The reason being because you would have to use a lot. You have to use 45 mL per kilo to increase the albumin by 1 gram per deciliter. So if your patient is hypoalbuminemic, you have to use liters and liters of plasma, which is not correct from an economical point of view. The reason why you would use fresh frozen plasma is to patients which have coagulation problems. You need to, for example, rodenticide poisoning or patients which are in DIC, for example. Another natural colloid is human serum albumin. And there was this study, large study, which was the SAFE study, which was comparing human serum albumin to saline for resuscitation. And they saw that in sepsis, patients who received albumin had a better trend towards survival. Meanwhile, patients in trauma had poorer survival. And this is easily explained now, like the trauma guidelines are coming out, and they show that the first thing you have to do in a patient with trauma is not overload them, but give crystalloids and restore blood circulating volume. And then you can think about doing other things. And actually, if you start with other things earlier, you have a poorer survival. Albumins also have antioxidant and anti-inflammatory properties, but they can give anaphylaxis, and this is mostly at the second infusion, or they can give delayed reaction after some weeks. If you overdose your albumin, you risk to have pulmonary edema. Another thing is that patients which are sepsis or which are hypoalbuminemic may be hypoalbuminemic because they have increased space in the vascular, in the vessels, you know, in between cells. So the membrane is more permeable and allows the albumins to get out. So the reasoning why, you know, if he loses his albumin through the vessel, why should I give human serum albumin? Because he will lose those as well. But actually, it takes longer to lose that, and you have a little bit of time to get the patient better before he will lose them. They will leak through the vessel, but you have a little bit of time to get the patient better. The dose of albumin required is in this equation, which you have here, which I will not go through, but you have it in your webinar. And the rate is 1 to 3 mL per kilo per hour. Another natural colloid is oxyglobin. You used to find oxyglobin, then it went off the market, and then it came back on the market, but at the moment we are kind of struggling to find it. Oxyglobin is modified lactate Ringer solution, and it contains 13 gram per deciliter of polymerized bovine hemoglobin. It is licensed for dogs, but it is used more successfully in cats. Not that it's not successful in dogs, but in dogs it is easier to do blood transfusion. Like some of us have packed red blood cell in our hospital. Meanwhile, you cannot store blood from cats. You have to sedate the cat, cross-match the cat, get the blood from the cat. So it takes a bit longer. So if your patient, feline patient, is bleeding out on the table in theater, you don't have time to do all that. You can use, you have to, you, it would be better to use oxyglobin in that case. It is a potent vasopressor and colloid, and because it contains oxyglobin, it increases the oxygen carrying capacities of the blood. Hence, it is, as you remember in the beginning, carrying oxygen and delivering oxygen to the tissue is the most important thing of circulation. It also releases oxygen to the tissue more efficiently, so it's good. And it has a long shelf life, but once used, you have to, once open, you have to use it within 24 hours. The duration of action is dose related and nobody really knows. And it has very strong plasma expansion properties. It can expand the volume up to 5 times the volume administered. So if you give 1 liter of oxyglobin, you will have 5 liters of volume expansion. In the dog, the rate is 0.5 to 8 mL per kilo. In the cat, the rate is 1 to 2 mL per kilo. But you don't, you have to go at 0.5 mL per kilo per hour because cats are more sensible to volume overload. It has side effects. It can give volume overload. It can give volume dilution, hemodilution, and it can give discoloration of the serum and mucous membrane. You can see this cat is very ecteric, but it's actually just because he received oxyglobin. It will interfere with further measurements of PCV and clotting times, but platelets will remain unaffected if you're worried about those. And also urine dipsticks may be unreliable. And then you have bloods and bloods component. You would use blood if your hemoglobin is less than 7 gram per deciliter. In dogs, because they rarely have naturally occurring alloantibody, you can do a first unmatched transfusion. And then the antibodies are produced within 4 to 14 days. So after 4 days, I advise you type the dog and cross-match the dog. So what happens is, if you do a blood transfusion today and you need another one tomorrow, then you can do it without matching or anything. But if you need one at day 5, then you have to cross-match the patient. Meanwhile, cats, again, because they're always difficult, they have naturally occurring alloantibodies. Therefore, you always have to cross-match the patients before you give blood transfusions. The rate, you all know you need to start slow to look for side effects and reactions, and then you can slowly increase up to 20 mL per kilo per hour. Of course, if the patient is bleeding out on the theater table, you can go at 999 and deal with an anaphylactic reaction later because he's dying anyway. In books, you will find several formulas to calculate how much blood you need to give. And there is also apps now on your smartphone or everything. So I'm not going through this, but you can find them a little bit everywhere. And they're here written for you. You can have transfusion reaction. This can be acute or delayed, so this can happen even days or weeks after you have given your blood transfusion. There can be immunologic or non-immunologic, and what you have to do is stop your transfusion immediately and give antihistamine and steroids unless it is contraindicated. I say stop your transfusion, but again, if the patient is dying because he's bleeding out, just give your steroids, your antihistamine, and say a prayer. The transfusion reaction you can have are just vague, like agitation, nausea, vomiting, salivation, which you never know. Is it a transfusion? Is it not a reaction? Is it, you know, you never know what it is. And then you can have urticaria, anaphylaxis, pyrexia, so measure your temperature quite often, tachypnea, dyspnea, tachycardia, hypotension, hemolysis, jaundice. You can have everything, hemoglobinuria, and even seizures. And other, which are not like really, which are related mostly to the blood products, are hypocalcemia because of the anticoagulant you have in your blood transfusion, hypervolemia, hypothermia if you give cold blood, and transmission of infection, disease, and immunosuppression. So you need to look at this. Blood products have been linked to increased metastatic disease, and they have been linked to many side effects. So nowadays, we tend to be a bit less easy with our hand to reach that bag of blood. We give, like, you know, synthetic colloids first. The blood products most commonly used are whole blood, packed red blood cell, which are only the red blood cell, therefore the PCV of that solution is 80 to 90%, fresh plasma, and then if you freeze it, it's fresh frozen plasma, and cryoprecipitate, which contains von Willebrand factor and factor 1, 5, 8, 9, and 10, which you would use, for example, in Dobermans who have von Willebrand disease. So let's put everything together and quickly go through this case discussion. Let's say you have a three-year-old Labrador, which is 25 kilos. He had an XLAP 4 days ago, but he never recovered well. He is depressed, he is vomiting, his abdomen intense, fluid fill, and there is serosanguineous fluid oozing from the wound of your previous, yours or someone else's previous XLAP. You look at the fluid, it is septic, hence the patient has septic peritonitis, and he has enterotomy dehiscence, so we need to go into theater and sort this out. You do a PCV, it's 26%. You measure total solids, it's 42 grams per deciliter, so both of them are not fantastic. And then you measure lactate, which is 7.2 millimoles per deciliter. And for those of you who are not used to lactate, it's high. Normal should be, depending, 2, 2.5 millimoles per deciliter. So lactate is increased. The patient is depressed. The heart rate is 210 beats per minute, and the pulses are extremely bouncy. The respiratory rate is 60 beats per minute, and the mucous membranes are tacky, pale pink. The CRT is more than 2 seconds, and you tense the skin, and there is loss of skin elasticity. So this is quite a dramatic case. This is the patient on arrival. You can see he is very depressed. You can see his mucous membranes are quite dry. You can see it even on the picture, which is impressive. So you can easily say that this patient is dehydrated, and I would say 10% because I can say it and he's not dead. So I go for 10%. And you can say he is hypovolemic because he is depressed, tachycardic, has bouncy pulses and high lactate. And then you have to consider that your PCV and total solids are already low, so you don't want to fluid overload the patient too much. So as we said, you need to correct the hypovolemia. You need to correct this first, and you need to correct this fast. So what I would do in this patient is I would give a bolus of Hartmann's, 20 mL per kilo bolus over 15 minutes, and then I would reassess the heart rate and see if the pulse quality has increased, if his mentation has increased, you know, how he is. Other things I could have done, I could have thought of, is giving albumin because his proteins are low, but they're still not that low. Or I could use hypertonic saline, no contraindication in using hypertonic saline in this case. So I chose to use Hartmann's, and the pulses became, the patient was slightly brighter, but still quite depressed. Heart rate went from 200, I don't remember what it was, 210 to 180, so it was good. And pulses are still bouncy, and the respiratory rate is 55 beats per minute. So there is an improvement, but it is not exactly, I'm not exactly happy to go to theater yet. So I have repeated boluses until the pulses feel fuller and the heart rate decreases. And this patient will probably need more boluses once he's in surgery. But you need to keep into mind that Hartmann's will eventually leak and will get only one third of your Hartmann's will stay in your vessel. So it will go in this third space. It will cause more wound dehiscence. It will cause edema. It will cause hypervolemia, which will destroy the glycocalyx and everything will leak even more. So you need to pay attention not to keep on bolusing the Hartmann's. I could have, after I have given my boluses of Hartmann's, I could have thought about using albumins because I surely diluted the protein even more. But if the patient is still hypotensive, then I can use inotropes and vasopressor. And these are, for example, dobutamine and noradrenaline, which you can find very well in the surviving sepsis guideline. I've put the guidelines here, and they explain very well what to do in septic patients and how to use dobutamine and noradrenaline. And another thing you should think of to maintain blood pressure is to use max sparing technique. So, for example, use fentanyl CRI to decrease your isoflurane as much as possible, because that will give hypotension, which means you will need more fluids, which means you're a bit stuck in a vicious circle. So in this patient, what I have done is I have repeated the boluses until I was happy. Then I went to theater. I have anesthetized it, and I have used fentanyl to decrease the amount of isoflurane I needed. I kept him on Hartmann's, and I used dobutamine and noradrenaline. And this was the patient's after surgery. So he was, well, maybe the day after. He was bright and happy and everything was fine. Once the patient was out of surgery, remember that he was also dehydrated. So we need to correct the dehydration. And this is the formula you had in the beginning. You have maintenance, which was 50 mils per kilo per day. And then you have, let me get the little arrow here. So you had to give maintenance fluid here, 50 mils per kilo per day. The patient is 25 kilos, so 50 times 25. And then I had to replace. The patient was 10% dehydrated, which gives me 0.1, times 25 because he is 25 kilos, times 1,000 to transform it in mils. And then I have to look at what comes out of the chest, of the, sorry, wound drain, how much urine he produces, is he vomiting, is he having diarrhea. I measure all this and I decided it was 500 mils per day. I put all this together and it was 4,250 mils per day. So to know what I have to put my pump on, I divide this by 24 because there is 24 hours in the day, 25 kilos of the dog, and I had to put the dog on 7 mils per kilo per hour. So quite high rate of fluids even postoperatively, but that's because he was quite dehydrated and a lot of fluid coming out of the drain. Practically, what you need to understand from today's talk is that you need to know your fluids and you need to know that they are drug. They have effect on your body, mostly good, but they can have also bad side effect. Correcting volume deficit is more important, so it is more than choosing which fluid to use. You need to correct that volume deficit as fast as possible, and then once you do your dehydration, you can choose your fluids better. Tailor fluid therapy to the patient, so don't just reach for any bottle, and then monitor the patient, monitor the clinical sign, look at how well your patient is doing, and go from then. And I am free to take questions. I have a question here from Maria. How can we relate the weight of the swabs in a bleeding patient to the volume of crystalloid needed? Thank you. So you weigh the swabs, as you understood, and for example, a swab is 500 grams, you will remove the weight of that swab from the 500 grams. And let's say you have 430 grams, means you have lost 430 mils of fluid. So if you have lost 430 mils of fluid and you want to replace this with crystalloids, you will have to give three times the volume loss. So I didn't choose an easy number, but you will have to give 430 mils times three of crystalloid. So I think I don't know if Maria is still there. Does that make sense to you, Maria? Thank you. In the meantime, I'll answer another question. Is how do you measure ongoing losses? And you need to measure ongoing losses. It's an approximate measurement. So you can put incontinence pad or towels or anything under the patient. Or if you put vet beds, you weigh the vet bed before you put it in, and then you weigh the vet bed after. And if the patient has been vomiting or having diarrhea or peed in his bed, those are all ongoing losses. And again, if you have, if your vet bed, the weight has increased by 1 kilo, exactly the same as the swabs before, it means that the patient has lost 1 liter. So 1 kilo of fluids is equivalent to 1 liter. 100 milligrams, 100 milligrams is equivalent to 100 mils. And then a very interesting question. If Hartmann's contains lactate, are you worried about giving it to patients with high lactate? This is a question which comes out very often, and it's a very good question. Hartmann contains both L and D lactate, and the L lactate is oxidized and consumes hydrogen ions. Therefore, it is an alkaline solution, and you don't have to worry about that one. The D-lactate instead is metabolized in the liver slowly and will be used to produce energy. And this D-lactate is the one you should worry about. But even if the patient has severe liver disease, it will never be enough to cause hyperlactatemia. And there has been only one case report about a patient with severe liver disease which were given Hartmann solution and had high lactate, but everybody uses lactate in patients with liver disease with no problem. It's a bit like your potassium in Hartmann's and in the patient with high potassium. It is not enough to cause a problem. Another question from Maria, does volume equals weight in urine and blood, right? Yes. So the question of Maria is the volume of urine of blood equals the volume of, the weight of urine and blood equals the volume of fluid I need to give. Yes. You have 100 mils of urine, you need, 100 milligrams of urine, you need to give 100 mils of fluid. You have 1 liter of blood, you need to give 1 liter of fluids. But again, always going back to Maria, you need to look at which fluids you are giving. If you're giving crystalloids and you have lost 1 kilo of blood, in reality, you have to give 3 times the volume lost. So you will have to give 3 liters of fluids. Does that make sense? Question, what fluids do you prefer in hypoglycemia? What I do in hypoglycemia is I get a bag of Hartmann's or a bag of saline, more often Hartmann's, and I create my own solution of my own glucose solution. So I get the dextrose solution, which is 50 milligram per mil, I think the 5% solution, and I create a 5% solution of glucose in the Hartmann's. So if I have a 500 ml bag of Hartmann's, I would put 50 ml of that glucose solution in my fluids. But I would not use that dextrose. I don't think there are any other questions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Alessandra for an excellent presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.